The bottom line in business talk. Voice America Business.
Welcome to Managing Technology the Right Way with your host, Sunjoe Gall. All comments, views, and opinions expressed on this show are strictly those of the hosts, guests, and callers. Now showing you how to manage technology the right way, here's Sunjoe Gall.
Morning, folks, and welcome to the show. It needs careful planning and flawless execution to make technology work for us. But how many times do we succeed? On this show, we invite business leaders and subject matter experts with extensive experience in technology management. The intent here is to learn from their experience and discuss better ways to manage technology. To learn more about the show, please visit talkshow.avval.com. That is talkshow.avval.com. Today's topic is ethical issues of an IT organization. Our guests for today's show are Peter Madsen and Keith Darcy. Peter is the executive director for the Center for the Advancement of Applied Ethics at Carnegie Mellon University. And Keith is the executive director with Ethics Officer Association, the largest organization of ethics and compliance practitioners with over 1,200 members worldwide. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
So how is holiday season treating you? We were just, of course, talking about the snow part, but how is the overall holiday season?
We are a busy people in a busy culture, and I think it gets even busier around this time of year. So hopefully everybody that's listening and ourselves get a chance to sit back and renew a little bit and get refocused for the new year.
Well, we're just wrapping up our end of the semester. This is our last week of classes, and I think we're all looking forward to the end of it.
Great. So we have picked up a topic which many people, I guess, hate to discuss because this is something where most people don't have an answer. But guess what? That's why we have gurus like you coming on the show and sharing your insights of what you've seen organizations doing to meet this challenge. So before we get into saying that, okay, we have an ethical issue within an organization and we are talking about an IT organization that is an IT department within a company, what is the first thing we have to do to, in fact, diagnose that there is a problem?
Let me take a shot at it from one standpoint, which is, the ethics of an organization are made up of both the formal and increasingly, by law, the informal policies and rules and compliance requirements that we have to conform to. And at one level, you can diagnose through different processes but where some of the issues may reside. You look for weaknesses in the compliance reports that come out, in the audit reports, application to policies and the law. You take a look at where HR complaints may be emerging, litigation against the firm or the division, risk assessment, conflicts of interest, and really try and diagnose where are the weaknesses that we see and come up with a risk profile within an organization. And we'll speak to this as we go through the program a little bit more about the requirements by law for risk assessments.
Well, I would agree with what Keith has just said, and maybe just go a little more fundamental as well. In my coursework with students around business ethics in general and IT ethics questions as well, I think there's a general way that we can diagnose ethics in almost any organization, which isn't to say that IT organizations don't have their own specialized problems. But I like to make the distinction between conduct issues and cognition issues. Keith has just talked about, I think, primarily conduct matters, the way people are conducting themselves on the job that might impact their work, that might be legal, might be illegal. These are all things that make the headlines, unfortunately. I like to call that managerial mischief-making, all the recent scandals that we've seen, for example. This would all be around the issue of conduct. But there's a whole other set of problems that require cognition on the part of managers and IT people and organizations of that variety. I like to call these moral mazes. Managers are confronted with a whole host of moral mazes today, and these are ethical issues, ethical problems, ethical dilemmas, and I think both kinds of activities, mischief-making and moral mazes, really need to be addressed differently, and hopefully during the program we'll have the opportunity to look at these two distinctions as well.
Good.
So when we talk about, again, going back to the diagnosis or for that matter, the root cause analysis of that to be done, you see that if I were to go and say, I have a quick way of making a buck or to get some material benefit, or if I can put somebody down and I can myself you know, grow in the organization or get some kind of favor from a superior just by, you know, tweaking the facts, if you will. So then that is usually the agenda that individuals would be, you know, we would have ethical issues because of that. So we know that these things happen on a daily life, on a daily basis in most organizations. So do we just accept this and just do a damage control?
No, I don't think damage control is the way to do it. I guess I'd introduce the provisions of the U.S. sentencing guidelines, which came out in November of 1991 and were revised in 2001. But essentially, they emphasize the need to prevent and detect issues where there may be grievances against regulations and or the law. But I think the underlying question still that you're posing, Sanjog, is addressing the issue that Peter just brought up, which is the cognitive issue. You know, how do we embody our values in an organization, and how does the organization then create the space for people to be able to express those values in a way that's positive, constructive, works for the success of the organization?
I think that's right. What I think Sanjog is referring to, oftentimes people want to take opportunity to gain for themselves. It's a sort of a, almost an ongoing premise among academics in particular, that people act out of their own best self-interest. And they'll sometimes slip into this attitude that anything that will promote self is going to be acceptable, that the ends justifies the means. I guess the slammer is full of people who believe that. Unfortunately, it's very difficult sometimes to head those kinds of people off who are hell-bent on doing the wrong thing.
Right.
But organizations can indeed, and I think Keith is very right, and the sentencing guidelines suggest that this can be done too, that there are programs that can be put in place. There are mechanisms that organizations can use. There are values that can be identified and hopefully practiced organization to organization.
Well, what's interesting, too, in terms of the sentencing guidelines, and this is the U.S. Sentencing Commission that prescribes to the federal courts the punishment on federal crimes, and they offer some latitude in each, but the idea was to create justice where the same crime on the East Coast, West Coast, North or South, male or female, white or black, would be adjudicated the same and given the same sentence. It hasn't quite worked out that way.
Right.
But they offered an incentive to organizations who put into place effective ethics compliance programs. And from 1991 up until 3 years ago, just to give you an example, our organization, which is the Ethics Officer Association, we grew from a founding group of 16 members to 600 members. In the last 3 years, we've grown from 600 to 1,250 members, and so we're seeing the impact of Sarbanes-Oxley. But the point that I want to make here is Sarbanes 905 asked the U.S. Sentencing Commission to go back and to look for revisions in their guidelines so that they would align themselves better with the spirit and letter of Sarbanes-Oxley. They did so last November 1st, and the law now states that in addition to law compliance, you must have ethics standards and a corporate culture that embraces them. And lawyers know what law compliance means. You know, it's non-negotiable. It's you've got to check the box. You've got to make sure that you've evidenced that you comply with the law. But there's a new standard that's being held out there, and it's called ethics and culture. And culture is an enormously powerful influence in organizations. Culture is the way things really get done. So you can have all the processes you want, but culture is the thing that's king at the end of the day, and culture trumps compliance.
Let me ask you this. We have all heard about the fact that everybody, to some extent, has got some self-interest. And that's why they're doing things in their daily lives. And the fact is to channelize that self-interest into making things productive for themselves, make them successful at the same time, and the whole process make the organization successful in which to which they belong. So while we are always talking about bringing something to these people, like a policies, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
But would it not be better for us to take a human route where we say, okay, you are my guy, you have some self-interest, let me help you meet those interests,
mm-hmm.
but in such a way that you do not try to find, you know, indirect ways which could be more harmful. So let's realize that everybody is coming and working in a company to get paid, and of course
yeah.
for their professional satisfaction, but everything is theirs, not for the company.
Yeah, well, what we're really talking about there is cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
And this has to do with enlightened self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to disagree primarily with this assumption on the part of many academics that we promote ourselves and we only act out of purely self-interested matters. And there are many studies, and the debate is quite thick and heavy, but I think at the bottom line, as I view it, people on the job, yes, they're concerned about self-interest, but societies and businesses and cultures, to echo Keith here, aren't built by individuals per se. They're individuals in consortium with other individuals.
Right.
It's a kind of notion of a group self-interest, if you will, rather than just individual self-interest.
But there is a challenge here, and I agree with everything that Peter just said. And the challenge goes back to Adam Smith. I mean, he basically talked about the foundations of capitalism. He was not an economist. He was a moral philosopher. And so the whole notion of capitalism has a moral foundation to it. And he did say we would act out of our self-interest, but only to the extent that it also met some larger good. But what was interesting, if you follow the history of capitalism, we haven't always known where those boundaries are. And you get out to the 1820s, and we had child labor and unsafe work conditions, so it gave rise to a labor movement and ultimately the passage of laws to support that. We get to the 1890s, and the robber barons are there, and the government has to step in and create the Sherman Antitrust Act. And the whole history of capitalism tells us that when we fail to self-regulate, government steps in, that re-regulation takes place. And so I think there is a responsibility that goes with that self-interest. And it's a responsibility to a larger community of people. And frankly, the only way you win the race is together. And I think people need to understand that. And I'm not sure we're quite there yet. Coming out of the 1990s, I think there's still a fair amount of confusion by people about who we are and what we represent. But there's enough self-interest out there. But I agree with Peter that they've got to recognize the need for cooperation, because that's who we are. We're 6 billion units in the world, and we've got to find ways to cooperate. That's a real challenge.
Just to put what Keith has said in just a slightly different way, and to also go back to this whole notion of capitalism, if people aren't on the job, aren't going to be paying attention to the so-called invisible hand of the marketplace, you're right. Government's going to remind them that there is
absolutely
a need to cooperate. There is a need to recognize that we're in a kind of utilitarian enterprise here, that we're all in this together. We're building a society, and we're building a general culture, and that wrongdoing is really tearing that down.
Yeah, absolutely.
So is there ever a concept discussed in terms of a group ethics versus an individual's ethics?
Oh, yeah. If you look at the whole area of evolutionary psychology, trying to account for where ethics come from at all, the original argument there is that people act out of self-interest. They are indeed doing so because in evolutionary times, when we were hunters and gatherers, that was a primary way of survival. If you didn't take care of yourself, you didn't run away from the elements that were about to get you, you're not going to live. So self-interest becomes very paramount. But then it became clear that it was the group that was going to survive together, and tribal unions grew. So evolutionary psychologists will suggest that there are two kinds of sources for ethics: self-interest as well as group ethics.
Yeah, and you know, just even the word ethics comes from the Greek ethos, which means customs or traditions. What is customary or traditional? What's accepted by the larger group? And so there is a group concept to even the term ethics. And I've long said, and I know Peter would agree with this, that ethics is not a personal matter. It's interpersonal, and it can only be known between communities of people. And that's the struggle that we have between the I-ness and the we-ness. And you know, there's a large gray in the midst of that, but it is part of the struggle. And over time, we harden our values and our concepts about what's right. And you know, what's right is what's right for us, but it also has to be right in the larger context as well.
And in fact, when we see that there are ethical issues which would have caused the most damage, usually they are not done by individuals. Usually, a group is involved.
Well, that gets
conspiracy.
Yeah, exactly. In some cases, and we've certainly seen that with these, enormous frauds. It's the Enrons and the Worldcoms. I mean, you know, people have to reflect on what we've been through here the last 3 years. Enron, which never had a down quarter in its history, within 6 weeks from a disclosure of some accounting irregularities in one of their off-balance sheet partnerships, declared bankruptcy. This is the seventh largest company in the United States. $63 billion bankruptcy. Was the largest bankruptcy in the history of humankind. And 6 months later, WorldCom eclipsed it by a factor of 1.8 times, $107.5 billion bankruptcy. But I agree with Peter. Those were conspiracies there, and management by winking and a whole bunch of things. But there's a whole bunch of other issues going on out there because the scandals haven't stopped. And in many ways, people step into some of these issues small steps at a time, and then they wake up one day and they find out they're embroiled in some enormous scandal because when it gets put on the front page of the New York Times, it doesn't pass the test.
Let's take a quick break, listeners. We'll be right back after these messages and talk about prevention a little more, where we can look at the education system that we have, the IT leaders who are actually bringing the people on board, and plus, of course, the HR of an organization which is doing the screening. And what can they do so that from, like, you know, you can get a bunch of, not so ethical people and try to fix those issues right there, or at the same time you can be proactive and not try to get to people and not try to kind of save the world make the world better. You might as well go and get right set of people in the first place and then kind of maintain that high level of ethics in an organization. So let's talk about it when we come back from the break. Please stay tuned.
Fresh, dynamic, and totally prepared for continuing business education. Business Talk Radio. Voice America Business at voiceamerica.com.
Looking for ways to improve your IT department? Then visit www.avval.com today. Aval is a professional services firm with a mission to help companies align IT with their business objectives through strategy, technology, branding solutions, and services. Our commitment is to ensure bottom-line improvements as a result of services rendered by us, whether it's an IT needs assessment, strategy development, or related implementation. We back it up by our unconditional, positive ROI guarantee. To find out how Aval can help your company, visit www.aval.com or call 1-800-947-2832. Aval, making IT work and look better. www.avval.com. Visit today.
Do you have an invention or idea and you don't know what to do next? Do you ever wonder what the differences are with a patent, trademark, or copyright? Remember seeing that million-dollar idea that you came up with a few years earlier, like the pet rock, clapper, slinky, or the remote control finder? How do I become a millionaire off my genius ideas? Hear answers to these questions on You Invent It, We Protect It, every Thursday at 7 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Your hosts, attorney Stephen Levitt and Jillian Freed, and their panel of experts and inventors just like you will discuss these questions and many more. So tune in to You Invent It, We Protect It, every Thursday at 7 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, right here on business.voiceamerica.com.
Are you looking for a unique perspective on today's market from an experienced economist? Well, look no further. Listen to The Economic Contrarian with host Mike Norman every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time on Business America Radio. Mike and his guests will discuss new trends in the marketplace, as well as emerging companies and opportunities. So if you want in-depth analysis from a contrarian point of view, don't miss The Economic Contrarian Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Pacific Time right here on BusinessAmericaRadio.com.
The bottom line in business talk. Voice America Business.
You are listening to Managing Technology the Right Way. If you have a question or comment, call toll free at 1-866-233-7861. Now back to the show. Here's Sun Jogal.
Welcome back to the show, folks. For listeners who've just tuned in, today's topic is ethical issues of an IT organization. Our guests for today's show are Pete Matson and Keith Darcy. Peter is the executive director of the Center for the Advancement of Applied Ethics at Carnegie Mellon University, and Keith Darcy is executive director with Ethics Officer Association, the largest organization of ethics and compliance practitioners with over 1,200 members worldwide. So before the break, we started talking about prevention, just basically extending that conversation, where we are talking about getting few people in the organization, and in the first place, let's screen them well so that we do not get a lot of people with an unethical bent and then try to help them become more ethical. Instead, we should have a proactive approach, have your education system, which would basically breed a bunch of good ethical individuals who are ready to go and make a difference in organizations. Then we talk about HR, which does the screening, and finally the IT leaders who induct them in and maintain and, you know, empower them so that they maintain their ethical status or like ethical standards within the organization when they work. So what is being done in that regard, and what have you seen are the challenges and how people are trying to fix them?
Well, let me just speak first to the idea of what the educational system can do and firsthand experience that I have. I'd report to you and your listeners that there's a major debate going on that really has been going on for some time, in business schools in particular, about whether or not ethics education should be a matter for consideration or not. Even after all the scandals that we've been talking about earlier, there are some business schools who have decided to drop their ethics programs entirely. Thinking about one down the street from us called the University of Pittsburgh, caused a great scandal among business ethicists that they did so. They lost some faculty to other schools. And it's a real problem because the question is this: can ethics be taught at all? And it's a great debate among academics. That question actually was raised by Socrates over 2,000 years ago. And the question is one where biases seem to come forward. There are people who believe that ethics is not teachable, that you can't make somebody moral. You can't make somebody virtuous. As opposed to that, clearly I'm on the side of being opposed, there's the idea that what you can teach are some skills, some ethical analysis skills, some skills of reasoning that can help people solve these moral mazes that I referred to earlier. You can help them solve ethical dilemmas. You can create skills within them that they can analyze these various problems in a way that's going to be beneficial to their organizations. So it's a very interesting debate that's going on in the education system. Some schools are doing a very good job in terms of integrating ethics in already functional course areas. However, some are not doing such a good job at all. Even the accrediting agencies for business schools are concerned that there's not enough being done. So that's how it stands at that level, the educational level.
Yeah, and I would support that, what Peter said. You know, it's interesting. I think the development of critical thinking, critical reasoning skills, what Peter first referred to as the cognitive issue, is raising the consciousness about where these issues are. Because, you know, we get swept up in our daily lives. We're so damn busy with our cell phones going off and Blackberries and sitting in front of our computers that, you know, we become part of a system. And so you need to get people to pause and think and reflect. And that's what the executive education and universities are for, is to get people the time and the space to reflect on what's most essential in themselves. What's also interesting, business ethics as a formal topic is only about 35 years old. Previous to that, ethics was taught solely out of the philosophy departments. And so as an applied science, it has moved, if you will, into business schools. It's been mandated by a number. And I think what we're the part of the debate, too, is whether you have a standalone ethics course or you integrate ethics in each of the courses in the business disciplines. And, you know, my vote is integration with a standalone, but, you know, because the argument is you could be sitting in the finance class on a Wednesday at 9 a.m. and a great case study on M&A, and you raise your hand, you say, "Professor, boy, that's powerful. I love that, the market value to book value, return on equity stuff. But I think there's an ethical issue in this case." And he says, "No, it's Thursdays at 2. And unfortunately, we do the same thing in business. You know, you go to the CEO, and we just made an acquisition. You said, "Boy, it's a great acquisition, but, you know, that company, boy, they sure smell in one of their divisions. Now go see Darcy. He's on the third floor." And you can't separate it. It's got to be integrated into the fabric of everything that we do. And so universities are struggling with it. Harvard has just tried to revise their ethics program after quite a number of years because, I think, you know, the essence of it is it was suboptimal. And so, you know, I think Carnegie Mellon, Georgetown, UVA, there are schools that do a very credible job with it, and you know, I think integration with some standalone, you know, is certainly something that universities have to pay attention to.
You know, also you mentioned what organizations can do themselves, and maybe this is a matter of screening and trying to find individuals with values that are desirable, but they're doing this in some very different ways. There are some organizations that are employing what are now called honesty tests.
Mm-hmm.
These are paper and pencil tests that mean job candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And here they're trying to measure whether or not, indeed, these individuals are honest and have integrity. I'm not so sure this is a very acceptable form of measurement.
I agree with you.
Nonetheless, it's going on a lot. According to the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment, 5,000 to 10,000 business establishments use honesty tests every year. Mm-hmm. So it's a very prevalent form of screening.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that either, Peter. I would opt in on the screening and the recruiting and the socialization process. Really good companies, enduring great companies, know who they are, know what their values and their brand promises, and effectively screen people who will deliver that brand promise. Probably one of the preeminent examples is Southwest Airlines. Southwest Airlines has a brand promise that says we're going to give you cheap fares, fun flights, and on-time performance. They turn around 15 jets an hour compared to the industry average of 7. They turn them around in 18 minutes compared to 40 minutes for the industry average. When you land on the tarmac, the pilot and co-pilot come out. They help you down with your luggage. It's not because they love you. They want to get you off the plane so they can get the other people on and keep their on-time record. When they screen people, they sometimes have as many as 20 screens. People are hired on a temp basis, and they have to go through at least a 4-month training program. And only then do they bring people on board. They have 8% turnover compared to 21% for the industry. It's the only airline that's made money for years in an industry that's bankrupt. That is the alignment of a corporate culture to a brand promise. And I just heard a little story the other day, short. Somebody said that their daughter was working for Southwest Airlines, went through the training program a year ago, and the girl who graduated at the top of the class, she aced everything, didn't get hired because they didn't feel that she had the values that supported the brand promise. That's the alignment of corporate culture to brand promise.
That's interesting. On the other hand, though, too, and it's unfortunate, there are, on the record, examples of recruiters that are not doing a very good job in terms of honest recruiting.
Absolutely.
We get reports of companies that are engaged in poaching.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're trying to attract people from other businesses to leave their business.
Mm-hmm.
We get promises that they can't keep being made, especially to students.
Mm-hmm.
We get headhunters that are really not representing organizations the best. I think this was really the case in IT as well.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, when there's been many times a skill shortage, not so much today, but in the past, you can remember years where there was so much fighting over people.
Yeah.
Whining and dining of our students was going on mm-hmm. like crazy. And I would have students coming into class late because the night before they were out so long with these recruiters.
Mm-hmm.
So that's problematic too. I think if we want to recruit people with desirable values, we better have recruiters who have these values already.
Yeah, very good point. I agree with you.
So do you think this is an interesting point, because most of the organizations, especially in IT, they are suddenly having this acute shortage, and they're saying bring anybody, even a trespasser would be hired kind of situation.
Right.
You know, so with that kind of pressure on the recruiters, and they go while the ethical or some kind of a screening is required, the customers themselves push to get us the top-notch candidate. And, you know, while recruiters can do their own screening, how much of a screening is done internally by the organizations?
That's right. Yeah, I think you use the word pressure, and I think that's exactly what they're experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
They want warm bodies that have the degrees, and I think, unfortunately, ethics and values might be the last thing on their list.
Yeah,
that's going to haunt them later on, I guess. That's what it's going to be.
Having grown up in the banking business, I would also offer to you, I mean, go back to this trust factor. You know, in the banking business, if you don't trust someone, there's no future for them. You know, they've got too much access to potential fraud. And so that's the issue that you have to deal with there. And when IT professionals come into an organization, either full-time or even as consultants to an organization, the essence of what you have to do is socialize them to what your expectations are. And I probably, the best feedback I got, I had a consultant who was working for me. I was chief operating officer of a bank in New York, you know, half a dozen years ago. And he came in on a Monday morning and he said, you know, over the weekend we were upgrading the systems and I found something on one of your people's computers and I really need to bring it to your attention because I signed your code of conduct. And he blew the whistle on somebody. He understood what our expectations were. And I couldn't have thanked him enough because it saved us a tremendous amount of heartache and money in the long run. So how we treat people coming into the organization is very important.
And in fact, you know, if you trust people, they reciprocate. If you just always have that, you know, inkling, you give them a hint at all times that, you know, you've been watched, then
mm-hmm.
I guess you will see people to be sneaking out a lot more. a certain basic philosophy of how you make people do the right things.
Well, if you build a culture of trust, and it's not a 6-month rollout, it's forever. But I've walked into horrific cultures that either co-opt you to their system or they spit you out. Alternatively, I've walked into great cultures that self-regulate. These are cultures that easily identify people who are doing things counterculturally, and they either deal with them directly there on the spot, or they go to a helpline, or they find some way to deal with it, because they know that the reputation of the firm is at risk. It's the greatest asset any organization has, is the reputation.
Let's take a quick... Yeah, go ahead, Peter.
Well, I was just going to comment that often what the problem is that there's a handful of individuals who are pressuring others to engage in activities they shouldn't be engaging in.
Mm-hmm.
I think IT personnel in particular have this problem where they're asked to lose a document, create a document, or what have you. And this kind of pressure is very difficult to resist. And at Carnegie Mellon, I tell my students they've got to get ready for the day when they're on the job.
Mm-hmm.
And someone comes forward and asks them to do something that's either questionable, unethical, unprofessional, or even illegal. And they've got to decide now, how are they going to manage that? Are they willing, like Keith's example, are they willing to become somebody that, because they've signed and said they would, are they willing to become a whistleblower? And this discussion then leads us on to a very important question. Under what conditions are people morally required to become whistleblowers to begin with?
Yeah. Now, that's great, Peter. I agree with you. And that's a great message for your students, because the day will come for anyone who goes into business where you're going to feel the pressure to do something that you know is beyond what's appropriate. And how do you deal with it?
As we were saying earlier, Enron didn't happen by an individual. It was a group.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Let's take a quick break, listeners. We'll be right back after these messages. And maybe, you know, talk a little bit about what Peter just mentioned, is that what would be the characteristics that we would look for or try to breed a set of whistleblowers who would always be your extended arm, if you will, who are available, who are there, not always just, you know, watching somebody else, but they are doing their own stuff. But at the same time, if something is going wrong, they adhere to the code of conduct and come back and report such wrongdoings. And we will extend that conversation and see if somebody else who is not even in IT and he is coming and is trying to create a situation where an unethical activity would be carried out, and then IT crew joins that gang at the same time not knowing that they are part of this unethical activity, because many times you're not told what the business reason is, just you've been asked to do it, and it is not always that obvious that this is questionable. So let's talk about how we can identify such situations and what can be done so that when a business need for an IT project is looked at, then we not only look at just what the dollar savings, etc., would be there, but also look at the compliance with ethical policies of a given IT organization. So let's take this quick break. We'll be right back after these messages and talk about these topics.
Get dialed in, 1-866-233-7861. Up to the minute business talk. Voice America Business at voiceamerica.com.
Ever seen a hornet, Shelly?
No, ma'am.
Oh, well, you're five. What are you waiting for? They've built a nest outside your window. See?
No.
You will when you climb 15 feet up this ladder to get rid of them. Take this insecticide and broom and send those stinging meanies packing.
What if I fall? I could get hurt.
Oh, you know about gravity already. You're so smart. Oh, go, 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 go. The hornets are waiting.
Shoo, get away!
Agree with them, dear. Hornets hate high-pitched noises. Yeah, try not to swallow too many.
Get away!
Knock that nest out of the park.
You wouldn't treat your child like an adult, so why put them in adult seat belts? If they're under 4'9", they need a booster seat.
I can't see! Are they biting me?
Oh, that's so cute. No, honey, hornets don't bite, silly. They sting.
Ow!
For more information, go to boosterseat.gov. This message brought to you by the Ad Council and the U.S. Department of Transportation.
Looking for ways to improve your IT department? Then visit www.avval.com today. Aval is a professional services firm with a mission to help companies align IT with their business objectives through strategy, technology, branding solutions, and services. Our commitment is to ensure bottom-line improvements as a result of services rendered by us. Whether it's an IT needs assessment, strategy development, or related implementation, we back it up by our unconditional positive ROI guarantee. To find out how Evol can help your company, visit www.evol.com or call 1-800-947-2832. Evol, making IT work and look better. www.avval.com. Visit today.
Keeping you a step ahead of the changing world of business. This is Voice America Business.
You are listening to Managing Technology the Right Way. If you have a question or comment, call toll-free at 1-866-233-7861. Now back to the show. Here's Sun Jogal.
Welcome back to the show, folks. For listeners who just tuned in, today's topic is ethical issues of an IT organization. Our guests for today's show are Peter Madsen and Keith Darcy. Peter is the Executive Director of the Center for the Advancement of Applied Ethics at Carnegie Mellon University, and Keith is the Executive Director with Ethics Officer Association, the largest organization of ethics and compliance practitioners with over 1,200 members worldwide. Before the break, we picked up a very interesting topic, is that what would it take for us to build very good whistleblowers who are your extended, ethics police, if you will. Second is that we will just extend the conversation to see, and many times you will see that the business side of it would come up with a situation which is unethical, and they would like to have the IT people get involved so that they can create something without IT people knowing about the fact that it's an unethical thing happening here. So the due diligence is being challenged here, where we always talk about IT portfolio management, we talk about the ROI, the TCO, and the whole nine. For an IT project which is funded, we always talk about the what it's supposed to deliver as a system, but it never tells us what business, it may even tell you what business need is going to meet, but not go and check on the ethical side of it, that how ethical is it? By any chance, is it going to be violating any of those ethical policies out there?
Well, just to give some context to that primary question we had before the break about whistleblowing and the culture that may or may not be supportive of it, there's some interesting data that might be useful. The Ethics Resource Center, the oldest ethics center in the country, actually, they do an annual business ethics survey. Well, maybe it's not quite annual, but they've been doing it for the last 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell us things like the following, that 52% of employees observed at least one type of misconduct in the workplace in the past year, with 36% of these observing at least two or more violations. Now, what do they mean by misconduct, these 52% of all employees and 36% who see it twice or better? What they mean by misconduct are such things as 21% saying that it's abusive or intimidating behavior towards employees. Others, 19%, say they observed lying. And who are people on the job lying to? And this goes to your other question, I think, Sanjo. They're lying to their own employees. They're lying to customers. They're lying to vendors. Or to the public. They seem to be lying to everybody, unfortunately. 18%, again, we're trying to define what is misconduct according to this Ethics Resource Center survey. 18% say they have observed a situation that places employees' interests over organizational interests, classic problem of a conflict of interest. 16% are observing violations of safety regulations. Another 16% are misreporting actual time worked. Then we've got 12% talking about discrimination. 11% say they observe stealing or theft. And 9% observe sexual harassment. Now, here comes the whistleblowing information that I think is very interesting for all of us. The survey says that 55% of employees who observe misconduct at work reported it. 55%, that means 45% who observed it didn't. And unfortunately, this figure is down 10 percentage points from a 2003 survey. So this is, I think, an interesting bit of context. 45% of people witness this activity, this misconduct, but they're not saying a word, whereas 55% do. What do you think of that?
That is interesting.
It is interesting, and especially in this environment. As Peter said, this is a survey that's been done not quite annually, but certainly no less than every other year for an extended period of time, and they've been able to measure a lot of results and performance. One of the takeaways I had from the survey myself was taking a look at how many people see more unethical activity, and certainly that number appears to be up over time. And I think part of that also reflects, however, the environment in which we're operating in, which is clearly a post-Sarbanes-Oxley environment. And there's much more management attention, board attention on issues not only of compliance but of ethics standards. And there are systems in place to help people deal with these issues. I think the disturbing thing that Peter just said, of course, is the fact that 45% of the people are seeing things but not reporting them, and that's a number that is moving in the wrong direction.
That's right.
So when we talk about the fact that, you know, in fact, this is an interesting thing. We spoke about ethics and morality. Now, are these two synonymous, first of all?
Well, let me just give my take on ethics. I know Peter's far more versed in it than I am, but... ethics is how we choose and how we respond to everyday situations that are placed in front of us. And the way we express our choices is through our actions as well as our inactions. The 45% of the people were inactions. They chose not to act. So we have to see the concept of ethics built on the foundation of choice. And so it's what we choose to do, what we choose to accept as behaviors around us and so forth. And the next question is, and we had this earlier in the conversation, is, you know, can ethics be taught? Well, in fact, our value systems are shaped by our families, by our schools, by our religions, by a workplace, by Girl Scouts, by Boy Scouts, by Marine Corps, by the media. And, in fact, each of the social systems in which we reside tell us what's right, wrong, in, out, good, bad, left, right. And so we're constantly being shaped, often being given different values messages, by the way. So there's a real complexity about it when we come out. And I think this is the real dilemma of ethics. There are some things that are fundamentally wrong. We know that. And then there's this large gray that we wrestle with. And that's why this cognitive approach that Peter talked about early on, raising a sense of consciousness, getting people to embody and embrace the core values that they find most essential in themselves and in others, and acting on it, giving them the space and the courage to act on it. And this is a continuous challenge. It's not a six-month rollout. It's not a memo from the chairman of the board. It's got to be a multifaceted process.
Well, I agree with Keith, of course. This distinction between ethics and morality does come up in a lot of different contexts. But as you've already heard, I use the phrase moral mazes and managerial mischief-making. For me, the two terms really are very synonymous, and I almost use them interchangeably. But there will be some who will make some distinctions between them. But we'll get the chance to come back in a little while, too. I think there's some important information about the Sarbanes-Oxley requirements that deal with IT departments. We were talking about how do we prevent non-IT personnel from triggering unethical or even illegal activities, which require complicity from IT people. Sarbanes-Oxley, I think, can speak to some of that.
Let's take a quick break, listeners. We'll be right back after these messages. And, in fact, go and look at the very fact of our organizations are becoming global. They are very outside-centric. So we are interacting way more with our partners and other affiliates, and we are opening up our IT systems to them. Now, that automatically brings up a weakest link issue because we can only control what we own, and when we are trying to make it open to everybody out there, then we do not really know what is the ethical policy and what is the ethical, you can say, corporate culture of the other organizations that we are affiliating with, because we don't control them. So what do we do to deal with this weakest link issue? Let's talk about it when we come back from the break. So please stay tuned.
More and more people are starting their day with informative, focused business talk. Top experts. Today's business issues. Voice America Business at voiceamerica.com.
I know, being a college freshman is supposed to be tough, but let me tell you about my schedule this semester. All 18 credits. Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I have American Lit at 8:05 a.m., and then I only have 15 minutes to get to my 9:15 Ethics and Value Theory class all the way across campus. Then in the afternoon, Calculus 1. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, I have two lectures that go through lunch. Sociology of Families, then Intro to Microbiology. Pre-med. And finally, I have a double lab that ends around 9 p.m. Anyway, I just wanted to say thank you.
If a kid will do whatever it takes to get through college, what will you do to send her there? please support the United Negro College Fund and call 1-800-332-UNCF, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. A public service brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
Looking for ways to improve your IT department? Then visit www.avval.com today. Avval is a professional services firm with a mission to help companies align IT with their business objectives through strategy, technology, branding solutions, and services. Our commitment is to ensure bottom-line improvements as a result of services rendered by us, whether it's an IT needs assessment, strategy development, or related implementation. We back it up by our unconditional, positive ROI guarantee. To find out how Avval can help your company, visit www.avval.com or call 1-800-947-2832. Avval, making IT work and look better. www.avval.com. Visit today.
Are you feeling slammed and suckered in today's stock market? If so, then you need to tune in to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, Jordan Kimmel will train you in what you can do to beat up the big boys on Wall Street, as well as share his secrets to success so that you can buy and sell like a profit-pumping pro. Grab the bull market by the horns and listen to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
The Bottom Line in Business Talk. Voice America Business.
You are listening to Managing Technology the Right Way. If you have a question or comment, call toll-free at 1-866-233-7861. Now back to the show. Here's Sun Jogal.
Welcome back to the show, folks. Today's topic is ethical issues of an IT organization. Our guests for today's show are Peter Batson and Keith Darcy. Pete is the Executive Director of the Center for the Advancement of Applied Ethics at Carnegie Mellon University, and Keith is the Executive Director with Ethics Officer Association, the largest organization of ethics and compliance practitioners with over 1,200 members worldwide. Before the break, we just quickly touched the topic of the fact organizations are becoming more outward. They are talking to companies within the nation, internationally, and they are trading, goodies. They are having their IT systems all integrated and making it, they are opening them up for the world out there. So we could be dealing with a weakest link issue where, few people from our organization and others from the, affiliate organizations or even from outside, they could be indulging in ethical issues which might be affecting us directly or indirectly. So what do we do to basically safeguard against these or such issues? What steps can be taken?
Let me jump into this just a little bit, because I do think there's a parallel here. Sarbanes-Oxley does require that supplier agreements also have compliance standards well understood, and we've got a number of our member companies who actually train suppliers on the expectations that they have for the ways they do business. But I think the parallel example goes back to Y2K. Didn't everybody have to sign off on the process to make sure that everybody in the supply chain link was aligned and had signed off and had met all of the expectations that were required in order to make sure that the world didn't blow up in the new millennium? And, I think it's an extensive period, and this is part of the cost of compliance, and we're going to moan about the compliance costs for a long time because they've become egregious, but nonetheless, the only way you safeguard yourself is by making sure that your expectations for the way you conduct business with others is being met. And, at a minimum, that means setting your standards and making them known to people that you do business with.
So there's a case in this whole area of international ethics that has to do with IT. It's a Yahoo case. I'm sure you're familiar with it. We've got a reporter that Yahoo's been criticized by a group called Reporters Without Borders. We have a reporter in China who has used Yahoo's email service, used their servers to send email that the government of China has called the sharing of state secrets. So China had asked Yahoo to give over these emails to them in a way that they could then use that as evidence against the reporter. So Reporters Without Borders were very upset when Yahoo agreed that they should turn over this information to China. They called it a complicity, that What has happened now is that the trial has ended in the jailing of the reporter, the Chinese reporter, and according to this group, Yahoo is complicit in any torture or any treatment, as we know, in jail in China is not a pleasant thing, I'm sure, that this means that Yahoo is practicing a kind of relativism. Their argument, in fact, was that they were merely following Chinese law, that it was their law that they had to follow, and of course the Reporters Without Borders are arguing the only real problem for Yahoo was how much money would they lose if they didn't comply with the request.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a human rights issue on the one hand versus a capitalistic money-making issue on the other, a real dilemma that I think we're going to see more and more of this in the future, especially with China's IT posture the way it is, being very, very censored and being they want to filter everything. So we're going to see this issue come up more and more, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and I think the issue at the largest sense, in its polarized view, is moral imperialism or when in Rome, do as the Romans do. And as I say, those are extreme positions. And so how do you create a balanced approach when you go in there? I think one of the case studies going back about a dozen years ago was Levi Strauss. And they were having a town hall meeting. Somebody raised their hand with Bob Haas, the chairman, said, you know, I don't get it. You know, we have all these strong values at Levi Strauss for 150 years. Why are we doing in business in China where there are human rights violations? Long story short, he set up a China policy committee. He told them that they had the backing of the board if they came up with a unanimous decision. They came back 90 days later, and they had a split decision. One was for constructive engagement. That was the larger part of the vote. But there were dissenters who said, we got to exit China because this doesn't meet with our standards. Mm-hmm. And so Bob Haas slept on it, and he said, we're going to pull out of China. Now, Motorola Corporation at the same time went through the same process, and they decided to do constructive engagement. Both companies, I think, made great decisions because the process was open. They debated it openly. You know, they really, and you know, Motorola didn't achieve the kind of successes that they thought they would because there were different standards of doing business in China that they couldn't adhere to. Levi Strauss lost a footprint in the largest market in the world. They subsequently reentered, but these are the challenges that we face on a global basis, is how do we conduct business in other countries when their mores may be different? And the big issue we talked about at the break was corruption. And the one thing I always say about corruption, you know, everybody says, well, you know, it's common practice in certain emerging countries. And I said, but it's never done in public. It's always done in secret. Nobody takes out a full-page ad in the local Gazette and says, look at the deal we just made and the grease payments that we had to pay to do it.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree with you more, Keith. What we've got, I think, is a kind of history repeating itself. You even used the phrase constructive engagement, reminding me of the South African incidents.
Exactly.
Divestment versus constructive engagement then.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't it the case, too, that IT professionals are going to be facing this matter even more and more? A very hot topic today is international outsourcing of data projects.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are any number of countries that want U.S. IT company business, and they've got professionals and the skills to do the work well, and yet jobs are going to be lost here in the United States because of it. So
that's right.
It's a real ethics problem, again, a cultural relativism issue, and at the same time, a business issue.
Yeah, that's a great issue.
On behalf of the show and our listeners, I'd like to thank you, Peter and Keith, for sharing your insights, definitely very valuable comments about how IT leadership and the IT organization in general can foster a highly ethical environment in their, within the team, and they can really come together and do good for the business.
Thank you.
A pleasure, Sanjog.
Thanks again. Given the esoteric nature and overall proliferation of IT, you know, it has really become a breeding ground for so many ethical issues, and of course there are so many stories that all of us listen to every day. Ethical issues may exist at an individual or at a group level. In fact, as we discussed, most of the biggest ones have actually always happened as a group. And, you know, this is a collective gain for which the employer might be paying a hefty price, and this also allows outside entities to exploit this internal weakness by selling inferior products, selling inferior services, creating, relationships so that they can get their, they can push their products and services, and which basically causes further damage. So can we force someone or a group to be ethical? Guess not. A good approach would be to learn about what the members of the IT organization want and see if those aspirations could be fulfilled. But we may also want to find, you'll always actually find many individuals who simply are unethical. They do not want to change. So then they should be sifted out or they should be yanked out from that organization. So can ethics be taught and drilled in the current and future workforce? Email us your thoughts at talkshow.participate@aval.com, talkshow.participate@aval.com. Thank you again for listening to Managing Technology the Right Way. This is Sanjog Aul, your talk show host. Till next Friday, take care and God bless.
Thank you for listening to Managing Technology the Right Way. Please join Sanjog Aul next Friday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time right here on BusinessAmericaRadio.com.